Welcome to the Human Capital Lab podcast, where learning transforms work and lives. Hosted by Executive Director Rich Douglas, we explore how education and innovation create opportunities to drive impact in the field of talent development. Get ready. Today's episode starts now.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Human Capital Lab podcast. It's an ongoing series of events focused on talent development and human capital management. Today, we have a particularly interesting guest with Dr. Philip Mead. Philip has a really strong background in organizational culture. You know, we talk a lot about culture, but we don't necessarily do a lot about culture. We tend to measure it, but then we go, okay, well, then what? You know, what are these numbers telling us and what do we do with it? And that's where it gets a little murky. And Philip has a really strong background in that area, particularly in one incident in his career that is to me defining, which is the second shuttle disaster, the Columbia, and what NASA did to recover from that and change its culture in order to help prevent that from occurring in the future. He's a co-owner and the chief operating officer of Leadership he's also a leadership expert in Gallagher Edge, and they are a consulting firm. And it's really based upon the work that he's done both academically as a PhD from the University of Central Florida, but also, you know, the work that he's done at a variety of different places, NASA and beyond. So, Philip, welcome to the podcast this morning.
Thank you, Rich. I really appreciate that.
Could you give, I know I've touched upon it briefly, but could you give folks an idea of your career path and the things that you've done? And the reason we do this is because our guests tend to be really wonderful models for our audience. So I'd like to kind of hear, you know, what was your path? How did you arrive where you're at today and some of the keys of the journey along the way?
You know, I've had a great journey in my career. I don't know if it's typical or atypical. I can't decide, but I'm really happy with the way it turned out. I went through undergraduate, got an engineering degree in electrical engineering, and came out and started working for NASA, doing payloads and working on, you know, helping to integrate different types of experiments into the payload bay of the shuttle and helping to build the International Space Station and do some of those types of projects, and got to do a lot of really cool experiments and things like that. But because I was working for NASA, I got put into positions where I was actually leading teams relatively early in my career. I realized that a lot of the stuff that I was really doing, I had never been prepared for in school, which was leading others. And so I went back to school and started getting a degree in engineering management. And so I got my master's in engineering management and then continued on and got a PhD in industrial engineering. And then I came back, and that was about the time that the Columbia accident occurred. And because of some of my background that I had, along with the PhD that I had, they asked me to lead all of the organizational and cultural changes for return to flight. Because I think you're aware of this, the accident investigation board found that as much as the piece of foam that struck the leading edge of the wing, it was the culture of Kennedy Space Center that caused the accident. And so they grounded the entire shuttle fleet until we could make the changes required for that. And so that singular event really served as a turning point in my career and really opened my eyes to a lot of things and changed me as a person.
You know, it's so funny. Research has shown the different ways that people come into the field of talent development and organizational development. And a lot of them come in as subject matter experts. They are, you know, skilled in their technical areas or wherever that they do it. And somehow they get involved, whether they're subject matter experts that, you know, get involved with training or with developing people. And yet they arrive and they stay, you know, and it sounds to me like this is really your career now. Coming back to the accident for a moment, I think it's important to note, and Laura brought this out in her podcast, and it's important to note that NASA had just been selected, or not selected, but it had just come out on top of the employee survey that the government does every year to determine job satisfaction, or employee engagement survey is what it is. And NASA had come out number one. It was, you could literally claim at that time, NASA was the best place to work, and the culture was, the culture was incredibly strong. It wasn't like it was some place that people were unhappy at or didn't enjoy their work or, you know, hated the job. It was quite the opposite. You were a band of merry brothers and sisters just tied to this idea of putting people into space and bringing them back safely. And yet, at the same time, it was that same culture that led to the disaster itself. Could you share with us more about that?
Yeah, that's actually what scared me the most about being asked to lead the culture changes is, you know, if I'd looked around and seen a whole bunch of problems, like, you know, people screaming at each other and their chairs being thrown, like, you know, okay, that there's obvious things to fix, you know, I know what to do here. But by all accounts, as far as I could tell, it was a great place to work. There were, you know, highly dedicated employees, people loved their jobs. One of the biggest problems we had every year was trying to force people to take their vacation time, for heaven's sakes. Like, that, this is the type of thing that we were struggling with. And so it was like, how am I going to fix a problem, you know, that I can't see? And it turned out to actually be a gift. And I think that it's one of the reasons why I feel like we have a better grasp on what organizational culture really is, you know, realizing that, you know, the way that we talk about organizational culture is that it's an emergent property. We view organizations as not just any type of system, but as a complex adaptive system, meaning that, you know, it's made up of adaptive agents, human beings that have, you know, the ability to make decisions and adapt to the things that you do, right? So they push back on you a little bit. And so when you have adaptive systems, they have emergent properties where you can't just break things down into pieces and parts and necessarily see what the outcomes are going to be. That's how we're taught to do things in school, right? We're told to break problems down into the smallest piece and solve that and then add things back up together. And that's what the solution is. But, you know, a simple example is if, you know, I give you some sugar, what creates the taste of sugar? You can't tell that by tasting the carbon and hydrogen and oxygen individually, right? If I give one of those to you individually and had you lick them, if that was even possible, right? You couldn't tell me like, oh, this is what sugar tastes like. You could combine those things differently and it's going to taste like vinegar. So the same thing was happening at Kennedy Space Center. Like we had the raw ingredients. We had highly dedicated employees. We had people that were, you know, they had the type A personalities, really super dedicated. They loved what they were doing, super mission driven, right? So you would think that all the right things are happening, but you've got this, you know, I think Malcolm Gladwell calls it an overstory. You have this cultural overstory that this is happening within, where you have a political environment where the International Space Station had just survived by one vote in Congress just a mere months before. And the International Space Station core complete, there was so much pressure to get that done. And it was tightly coupled with the space shuttle launches were integrally tied to that. So we actually, like, I had a countdown clock to core complete was my screensaver on my PC. And so I was highly aware of how important it was that we hit these schedule, you know, timelines. And we always thought that, you know, the program was in constant threat of cancellation. Like, you know, Congress was always going to kill it, or it was always going to be, you know, be canceled. And different political entities were always using the space program for their own personal, you know, purposes, for political reasons, for stump speeches or whatever. And so you take all of that and you wrap it together, and it creates this formula where what emerges is not necessarily what you would think would emerge, right? And so it's kind of a story I used to exemplify this is, if I took you up to the top of the Empire State Building and there was this beam sort of cantilevered out into space, at the end of the beam I'd taped $1,000, and I said, Rich, if you walk out on that beam and you get that $1,000, you can have it. Would you go out there and do it?
No,
nobody would, right? But if at the end of the beam was a loved one, now what would you do, right? Now you'd run out there, you wouldn't think about it. Well, I've just changed the risk reward calculation that's going on in your head, right? Well, I just described to you how much these employees loved the program. And I just told you that it's constantly threatened to be killed, right? So there's this phrase that I noticed was being bandied about all the time, is we've got to save the program. We were subconsciously, we were letting this idea get sort of creep into our decision-making processes that we had to save the program. And so the ability to make good rational risk decisions was becoming compromised slowly. And it was not because we didn't care, because we did care, but it was because we cared in an environment where there was unrealistic pressures that were being put on us. And we didn't have the ability to recognize how closely our personal identities were actually linked with the shuttle program. And we couldn't bear to think about the shuttle being canceled, because if the shuttle got canceled, then it was like we got canceled, because that's who we were. And so all this was tied up together in one big, huge ball that made it very difficult for people to really be able to step back and see what was happening to them.
So to what extent would you say that groupthink was a factor in this, where, you know, in groupthink, when that occurs, it very often stifles speech, objection, contrary thought, and so forth, because the need to be a part of the organization becomes so great compared to the willingness to butt heads against it. Was that a factor or dynamic going on there as well?
I think it was, but not in the way that I think a lot of people think it did. You know, I think there were, again, it goes back to identity. I think there are pieces and parts of identity of like what it meant to be a part of the NASA culture, right? That played parts of this. And, you know, you've read the book. I pull on a couple of them that are really obvious that they, you know, they have positives, but they can also have negatives. One is the failure is not an option. That's a big part of the NASA ethos. And that is it can be very positive for us because, you know, the failure is not an option can drive the workforce to try things and to go and to do things that many people would think are impossible and to achieve things that, you know, maybe otherwise wouldn't get done. But at the same time, what happens when you put someone into a position where they have this ethos that failure is not an option, but they actually believe that there's no way out, that failure is inevitable, right? Now you've put them into this sort of this, you know, cognitive dissonance that their psyche has to try to resolve, right? And so we saw that with Linda Hamm, and, you know, she put this, you know, statement to the board afterwards that there was no point in even trying to look to see if there was damage to the wing because there was nothing they could do about it. You know, if they found it, well, why would you say that? You know, that doesn't make sense. But that if you start to sort of peel the layers of the onion back, well, you know, she was just her subconscious didn't want to actually look at the problem because she couldn't face the fact that there was something that she couldn't solve. Like for her, failure felt inevitable there. Right. Another example is the, you know, in God we trust, all others bring data. Like that was a huge piece of the NASA culture, right? And you'd think like that's a great thing to have for a bunch of engineers. You would want to be very data driven, but here's a situation where we didn't have the data. Like the imagery was not clear enough to, without beyond a shadow of a doubt, say what had occurred. You had engineers who had decades of technical experience that was telling them that there was a problem, but it was just intuition. And they weren't willing to go on the intuition that they had to be strong enough to say, hey, we think something's really wrong.
Well, and they had a history of this because for those of you that aren't familiar with what happened, there was a heat shield and foam from the heat shield peeled away. And eventually we learned struck the shuttle and created a hole in the wing. And that hole ended up being where the integrity of the ship fell apart. The air came in as it landed, superheated, and that's what destroyed the aircraft, the spacecraft. But it had happened before. Foam had fallen off before and struck it, and they always dealt with it after the shuttle landed.
Yep.
So that was the way they approached that problem anyway, right?
We call that normalization of deviance, right? At some point when a deviance occurs so much, you start to normalize it. It becomes the new normal, right? So that's just now the way that things are. That's what had happened for that workforce. We had foam shedding was just the way things happen. There's always foam shedding. It's not a big deal. And so it wasn't a deviance. It was the norm.
Even though the deviance was there, the deviance had become normal.
Yeah.
And if I understand it correctly, Han ended up deciding that this was a post-flight issue, that this is what we deal with this when the shuttle lands. This is about getting it ready to fly again, as opposed to getting it down on the ground safely. And that obviously led to the disaster. What changes did NASA have to go through after that to be able to fly safely again?
The biggest changes were really structural within the organization. A lot of what we had done just to try to streamline things, to make things, you know, there was a big push at the time for, you know, better, faster, cheaper, and trying to get, you know, make things operational and make it as efficient as possible. And, you know, there's been a lot of criticism, both with the Challenger accident and with the Columbia accident, about trying to treat the space shuttle as if it was an operational vehicle instead of an R&D type of a vehicle.
Right.
But, you know, at the time of the Columbia accident, pretty much everything rolled up into a mission manager. So you had schedule and technical and budget, safety, it all rolled up into one person. So you had one person managing all those hats. And so there wasn't an independent path that someone could go up through to raise a concern about one of those things. And so one of the big things that we did is we split all of those out so that there were individual independent authorities, an independent technical authority, an independent safety authority, so that the mission manager wasn't trying to sit there and be responsible for all of those, because it's really too much to put on one human being to try and say, you know, you're responsible for making sure that the program is successful and launches on time and within budget, but also being responsible to ensure that we're adhering to all of these safety standards and that we're meeting these technical requirements. It's just too much for one human being. And so
it's even more than that. Then deal with all the political issues and all the pressures there and save the program. And, you know, and so it's really, like you said, and these are in other situations, it could create constructive conflict where we have, you know, safety and engineering and operations and budget and politics competing. You know, in competing, and so a good outcome arises from that competition. But instead, it becomes really tempting when somebody's got all of that on them to tamp it down, smooth it out, let things happen, be, you know, calm about it, which unfortunately tends to squelch, you know, that when somebody raises their hand. And it wasn't that a problem of people choosing not to talk, raise things because it felt that it wouldn't be heard.
Yeah. And that's another big part of the work we did, was trying to ensure that we were creating environments where people felt comfortable to speak up, you know, creating that psychological safety, helping leaders to create the environment where they were encouraging others to speak up, providing feedback to leaders after meetings to help them to see, you know, what they're doing and how they're creating that type of an environment to encourage others to speak up. That's one of the things we see a lot within technical communities, technical organizations. You have a technical individual, you interact in a certain way as a technical, a lot of times as a technical person, you have a tendency to engage in debate, in technical debate as a technical person. Then you get raised up into technical management or technical leadership, and you want to engage in that same way. And a lot of times people don't realize that same behavior is perceived differently by people who aren't at that level now. And it seems like, oh, you're shutting down, or they're just wanting to engage the same way that they did when they were a peer, but you're not a peer anymore. And so, you know, those same behaviors, they're not perceived the same by people. So, you know, you can't come at people with the same level of veracity, you know, to challenge stuff when you're a level or two above that you did when you were a peer. And it's just good old debate. Power discrepancy really makes a difference.
It's one of the ironies of promoting from within.
It is.
You know, we talk about all the benefits, but that's a real challenge when suddenly now you've got to make the distinction. You're in charge. You remind me of something that you see in the movies a lot, especially in the military. The junior person's talking to the senior person and says, request permission to speak freely. I'm a retired Air Force officer, been a commander in a variety of situations. I never, ever had anybody ask permission to speak freely. They just spoke freely.
Yeah.
So, the idea that I had to be coaxed into being open-minded to hear what this person has to say is just so absurd. Yet it can happen. People can feel in certain cultures, especially successful ones, I want to go against the grain here. This thing works. It's, and plus, as you said before, that having that strong sense of wanting to be part of it and be on the team, it really can build conformity, which looks like efficiency, looks like a strong culture, looks like, wow, everybody wants to be here, they love it, and so forth. Yet it also prevents the countercultural, or inhibits the countercultural thinking and being able to talk about it. Your book, which by the way, everybody, is called The Missing Links, Launching a High-Performing Company Culture. I co-written with your partner in crime, if you will, Laura Gallagher, who's been a guest on the podcast. Your book is really, in my experience, one of the, maybe the only, but certainly one of the few attempts to really break down and understand how cultures work and how they can be improved in the workplace. Share with us what motivated you to document this. I mean, it's one thing to do the operational work on the job. It's a whole other thing to say, gee, this is something we should share with others.
It started more simply, for me as an engineer, it was realizing that, okay, the organization is a system, so I can deal with that. I can work on a system, and then recognizing, okay, it's not just any kind of system. It's a complex adaptive system. And so once I realized that, then I was able to make sure that I was working on the system, the right type of system in the right type of way. And then I realized that, okay, it really starts inside of the human beings, right? So that was another key learning, is the things that were really, where culture really lives is inside the hearts and the heads of the human beings. And so it emerges because of the interactions of the common behaviors and beliefs of the human beings. So like sugar, the taste of sugar emerges because of the interaction between the hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen, and how those relationships are. It's the relationships between the behaviors and beliefs of the human beings in your organization is how the culture in your organization emerges. And so we started looking and saying, well, so how does this really happen in an organization? Like, how do we start to figure out how do we deploy this across multiple organizations and make this repeatable? And we realized that really there are four common traits that come up in highly successful organizations, and that is maturity, diversity, community, and unity. And you see those traits emerge really whenever you have a highly effective organization. And it all starts with that very first one, which is maturity. And that's because it starts at that individual level, and when you have, individuals that have the ability to manage themselves and their own behavior that enables them to come together and have challenging conversations and to accept feedback and to get work products done, that's really what defines that maturity. And so you can't work on maturity, right? It's emergent. It's just like that taste. So the things that you work on in your human beings to help them grow that maturity is you help them to develop their self-awareness, their self-acceptance, and their self-accountability. And okay. So those are the things that you can help your people to grow. And when you develop those things in your people, then maturity just naturally starts to emerge within your organization. So the more that you can focus on growing those three things in the humans in your organization, the more you'll start to see maturity emerge across your organization. And so figuring out what are those, and that's why we call them the missing links. It's like, how do we find those links? What are those links that we can focus on that we actually can work on that allows the emergence to happen, right? Because you can't grab the taste. So what are the molecules? What are the actual atoms that we can grab onto and manipulate down at the molecule level that we can work on? And so that's what we were trying to do. And so You know, it's there is a science of human behavior, so it's very science-based. And so we focused on the science of human behavior and said, okay, so what is it about human beings and how they work that allows us to be able to look into to humans and how humans and groups of humans work and interact together that allows us to produce these emergent behaviors in groups of humans that create these cultural traits.
Can we touch on the other three briefly so that people can be more cognizant of it when they go looking for it? And hopefully they'll look for it in your book.
Absolutely. So diversity is the second one. You know, diversity is critically important when you want to be able to execute change, when you want to be able to innovate. And so, you know, there's, again, three missing links there that you want to be able to bring together for that. You want to have differences, right? There, if everybody's the same in your organization, there's not going to be any diversity. You want to be able to have different, you know, that diversity comes from different lived experiences, different backgrounds, different ideas, different mental models. It's really all about the mental models that we have. So the lived experiences that we have creates those differences. But those differences don't do any good if you don't have respect for them. So you want to pull in the respect for those differences. And then obviously, if there's not inclusion of the differences so that you're pulling them together and including them when you're making decisions and when you're doing things, then it doesn't work. So differences, respect, and inclusion, you pull those three things in. If you're building that into to the way that people work, then that really allows that diversity to begin to emerge. And then for community, you know, and this one, we get a lot of questions about, okay, we're operating in a virtual world. How do we get community to emerge in a virtual world? Well, this is really the formula. Like, there's a formula for community. Community emerges when you take human beings and you put them together and you combine them to where they're interacting with a combination of compassion for each other. And compassion means that I have empathy for you, meaning that I see you as a human being. I recognize that you're not perfect, just as I'm not perfect, and I want to help you, right? So it's like that you need help and I want to help you, right? There's trust there. I trust you. And, you know, I know that you're going to do what you said that you're going to do. And I know that you have the ability to do what you say you're going to do. And I trust your intent that you have, you know, my best interest at heart. And then openness. Like you're being as open with me as I want you to be, and I'm being as open with you as I want to be. And so you bring those three things together, and that's where you get a community. And so a lot of that breaks down in the virtual world. You know, you just pick on the openness one. You know, when you have a team meeting and a bunch of people are coming together and half the videos are off, like that's openness is not there right there. And then you start to question, like for some people, like the trust starts going down. Well, their video's off. What are they doing? So there's trust questions that come up, rightly or wrongly. These are the stories that we make up as human beings in our head, right? We make up the story to fill it in. And so we want to try and make sure, like, how do we create these three things in that environment, you know? And there's ways to create trust in even in a virtual environment, you know? Trust is created by doing what you say you're going to do. So every time that you do something and then say you're going to do something and follow through with it, that's trust. Like responding to someone when they ask a question or say something, and, you know, that builds trust too. So, like, it destroys trust in a virtual world when someone like asks a question or says something in Slack or a DM type of a chat or something and no one responds to them. Like, these are weird little things that actually erode trust within a virtual world. And so being able to be intentional about curating that and maintaining, that's all part of building that community.
I can't let you go without underlining with a highlighter the word intent. You know, this is a fundamental difference. In managing in a distributed environment where people are in all kinds of different places, we as leaders have to have intent to bring people together and to foster positive communications. And, you know, so much of when we work all in the same place, we trip over each other. We have the, oh, by the way, conversations, you know, the by the water, as it were. But when we're in a virtual environment, as a leader, you have to take the initiative to bring people together and engage them. And it takes work. It's no longer, and I think this is a fundamental part of the urge to call people back to the office, because it's easier as a leader to have everybody in the same room all the time or in the same building, wherever. And it's a lot harder to say, you know what, people are doing their thing, they're doing what they need to do, but we still need to bring people together to have that clash of ideas, those hot experiences. And in order to do that, we as leaders have to set that up and foster that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're sitting in our offices or in our home or wherever going, I wonder if people are doing anything.
Yeah.
And that's a losing proposition. We've talked about maturity and how individual maturity leads to organizational maturity. And we talked about diversity. And when we talked about diversity, notice that you didn't just check some boxes, but rather you talked about what it actually is, which is different lived experiences and perspectives. And then we talked about community, building that sense of being a member of the tribe and being on the team, if you will. What's the fourth element?
Fourth element is unity. This is really, you know, as an organization, you're trying to get everybody on the same page and pulling in the same direction. And so, you know, if you want to get that unity together, it's all about defining a common purpose, you know, and usually this is a higher purpose, like, you know, that why that people really believe in, defining common beliefs and behaviors, like how do we, you know, what do we believe? How do we behave around here? What are our values? And then control. Control is a big piece of it. A lot of times people shy away from this, but people really do want control. Doesn't mean that they want to be over controlled, but they want to know where their boundaries are. They want to know what are the rules of the road. And then once they know what the rules of the road are, then they can operate within those. And so if those are well defined, then that's how you create that unity so that everybody's playing by the same set of rules. And so
it's been a couple of decades since the Columbia accident. Some organizations they go through something like that, or maybe not as dramatic as that. And they come out and say, we're going to make change. That's not us. We're not going to be that anymore. But people being people, very often the organizations don't freeze the new changes, and people tend to put things back where they found value in them, and they tend to undo some of the changes. Did you see a permanent change in the NASA culture before and after?
I think so. You know, the permanent change was actually the harder part of it, honestly. It was easier to make the immediate changes because it was such a significant emotional event for the entire workforce. So making the immediate changes, people were very receptive to whatever was asked. And so the long term was really about, it was slightly traumatic for me as an engineer, but I moved into HR and
you heretic.
I started an organization development group in HR and ran that for a while and got that running, and it ran for several years. And what the purpose of that was to just continue to work with each of the organizations individually, each of the directorates individually, to continue to do that work with them, to maintain the ongoing work of maintaining the focus on the human beings and the self and the awareness and the maturity and keeping these ideals alive and trying to avoid letting the complacency sink in. It's always a challenge with a government organization because it feels like it's never just entirely within our control. You know, there's always external forces that are telling us how we should be organized, how we should be spending our money, what we can and can't do. And so being able to justify spending money on having an OD group that is going in and doing retreats and focusing on employee development and self-awareness and all the self-actualization stuff to help people be able to be more open and realize when they're withholding and all these types of things. Like depending on the political environment, it can be a little bit challenging for people to realize why that's important, especially the more years it's been since there's been an accident, it's harder to defend. So that becomes the challenge.
And speaking of challenges, you're no longer in the midst of that environment. Now you are co-owner of the Gallagher Edge. Could you tell us what's your company doing? What are you into?
So we love working with companies that see culture as a catalyst for how they can, you know, make it to the next level. You know, if companies embrace culture as really the most important competitive advantage that they have, it can really propel them to the next level. It's the hardest thing for anybody to duplicate. And if you're, you know, Drucker said that culture eats strategy for breakfast. And the reason he said that, it's not that strategy is not important. Like, your strategy is critically important. It's just that your culture is what drives your strategy, right? And so, like, you need to have a great strategy, and someone can copy your strategy pretty easily, but it's very difficult to copy your culture. And so the key to being, like, really good and really difficult for someone else to copy is to merge those two together to have a great strategy and a great culture that is really tightly supporting that culture, so that the way that things are done here, the way that your people just naturally perform, the way that they believe and act on a daily basis, everything that they're doing and thinking and saying, it's driving your strategy, right? That's what you want, so that you're not spending a bunch of extra energy trying to force them to do what you want them to do. That's just who they are. That's what you want. And so if we can get that, when we have companies that believe that and we can help them intentionally design a culture around that, and they see that competitive advantage, we love working with companies like that. It's a really powerful driver, because it's very difficult for someone to come in and copy that. It's, you can't just, we have a joke. I think we put it in our book too. You know, you can't copy a company. It's not, you know, it used to be at one point in time, people thought you just put a ping pong table in the lobby, and that's now we've got culture now, and it's a little more complicated than that. You can't just come in and copy what someone else is doing, and now you've got their culture. So,
well, the culture's got its act together when the ping pong table gets covered with plans and ideas instead of people playing ping pong. That's great. You know, a good metaphor for this are sports dynasties. You see certain franchises, for example, who everybody that's there today, nobody was there when the dynasty got started. They're all gone, including the owners. I mean, everybody's gone. You know, the New York Yankees are an example of that, you know, or the Boston Celtics. Everybody's gone. Yet the culture, the ethos, the elements that you talked about continue, because they're passed on, because they're created and recreated. But it has to start somewhere. And I'm really encouraged by the idea that your company helps other companies get that start and really be able to make those changes to turn them into more high-powered organizations. As you said, yes, it's true. Culture eats strategy for breakfast. No doubt about it. Because strategies can change as circumstances change. But the culture properly built can withstand those changes and withstand the new challenges. Improperly built or missing key elements, and that culture can become staid, unable to adapt. So, you know, the value of having these elements in the culture is, it sounds paramount to long-term success of an organization or a company.
Yeah. You know, I mean, again, I'm an engineer. I like to think of it in, you know, engineering terms, but you know, if your company was a machine, if you think about how your people work together, it's like friction within the system, right? You're just bleeding off energy. You know, when you have ineffective organizational and team dynamics that's happening in there, every time that, you know, you've got people that are not really communicating effectively, so-and-so doesn't really want to talk to so-and-so, and, you know, this person is like dragging their feet over this, and, you know, this team didn't tell this team about that, and these two people are arguing about something else or whatever, all these little team dynamics that happen. Like, it's just, when you multiply that over an organization where you've got, you know, hundreds of people, and then you multiply that by 5 days a week, by, you know, 52 weeks a year, like, you're just, it's amazing how much productivity you're losing. If you can start to dial that in and get your culture tweaked up, there's just so much more performance that you can get out of your company, and so much more efficiency that you can gain. And, you know, your strategies and your initiatives, they start to run so much better when you can really do that.
Philip, could you share with our audience where they can find you on the internet in order to learn more information about Gallagher Edge? What's your URL?
Absolutely. We're at gallagheredge.com. That's G-A-L-L-A-H-E-R, Edge, E-D-G-E.com. We also, I mentioned the missing links and the four different traits. We have a nice little assessment, mini assessment that people can take if they're interested to kind of see where their company stands and assess how that's going if they want to. So there's access to that we could probably provide a link to that on your site as well.
We appreciate that. You know, we're non-commercial here at the Human Capital Lab, but we're not afraid of commerce. I'm more than happy to embrace it because commerce is such a huge engine and drives so much human success. And so, you know, we're more than happy to embrace it, which is why I want people to know about you and know about your company, because I read the book. I gotta tell you, you know, after 40 years of doing this stuff, it's just nice to see somebody break it down to a level of, you know, if you do these elements and you bring them back together, the dynamism of those four will create strong culture and then turn around and, you know, it's kind of the difference between competencies and capacity. You know, as a leader, you know, you need to know how to do these things. But what if we make you the individual, a bigger, stronger person? You're much more capable of doing those things. And it's the same with cultures. The stronger the culture, the more likely it can develop strategies and see them through. And if the strategy needs to change, well, guess what? A strong culture is also going to be mobile and be able to really move from old ideas to new ideas. So yeah. I think this is absolutely fascinating. The book, again, is called The Missing Links, Launching a High-Performing Company Culture, co-written by Philip and his partner in crime, if you will, Laura Gallagher. So I really appreciate you coming on today. But before we go, I want to turn the tables and see if there's anything else that you'd like to leave with our audience.
No, I appreciate the conversation today. It was a great series of questions. I enjoy talking about this topic. I guess the last thing I do want to say is, and you've alluded to it a little bit, we really do believe that, you know, we're helping to evolve humanity through the work that we do. It's not just about organizations when we're making these changes. I've seen it happen with our clients. I've seen it happen with myself. The impact that we have when we're able to help the culture at an organization improve, it improves the life of the human beings that are in that organization, and they take it home to their families. It makes the family life better. It makes, you know, it improves the lives of their children. Like, it's, you know, it improves the lives of their and make just makes the world a better place. So I think it's helping to contribute to make the world a better difference, because we spend so much time at work. Like, why would we want to spend so much time at horrible places? You know, we should spend time at great places where we feel like we are engaged and we're motivated and we believe in the purpose and we love what we're doing. And there's no reason why that shouldn't be the case.
And there's no problem with making a living while feeling that way.
Right.
So this has been great stuff. Dr. Philip Mead, thank you so much for coming on today. You're just a wealth of knowledge in this area, and the experiences that you share with our audience, I hope will be growthful. And I hope that they check you out at GallagherEdge.com, and please consider taking a look at the book. At least read the sample. Amazon will give you a chance to take a peek at the book. I found it to be transformative. And again, after doing this for 40 years and reading everything under the sun, to hit a book that actually goes, oh, wait a minute. It's a great experience. So thank you. It's one of the few of these books that I definitely will go back and reread. So thanks for that. Talk about making someone's life a little better through his work. You just did. So thank you for being on today, and good luck in your future endeavors.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you for joining us on the Human Capital Lab podcast, a Growth Network podcast production in collaboration with Bellevue University. For more info, visit humancapitallab.org. If you were inspired today, pass the link on to a colleague or friend. Stay tuned for our next episode, and until then, keep learning to unlock the long-term potential of human capital.